वंशकल्पतरूभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्येव च पतिथानां भावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीभासदी गौर भक्तवृंद। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम 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 हरे हरे।
I am very much grateful and honored to be among all of you this evening. Thank you for being here. There will be a beautiful concert by Gaurvani and As Kindred Spirits, so I will speak very briefly. What that means, destiny will reveal. As our dear Gaurvani Prabhu has explained, I was extremely reluctant to write a book about myself. But one of my very dearest lifelong friends made me promise him on his deathbed that I would write this book. And this is an offering to him. It is also an offering of gratitude to my mother and father who dedicated their lives to invest within me values and qualities that later on in the service of my Gurudev I could share with humanity. It is an offering of gratitude to the many teachers I had on my path, Jews, Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Jains, Hindus, Parsis, atheists who tried to kill me, even a mongoose. They taught me so many beautiful lessons. The whole book was written and fully edited, and we still had no name for it. And it was my very dear friend, Ram Das, or Rawal, who is the publisher of the book, Mandala Press, who said to me, "I think the best title is The Journey Home." And that became the title. What does the journey home mean? Home is where we feel shelter. A place where we feel loved. A place where we can go even despite all the agitation, stress, and tribulations of this world, and find real comfort. That home is within the heart of every living being. If If we cannot find it in our heart, we cannot find a real home anywhere. Because it is within the heart that the eternal soul, beyond all the designations of this temporary world, is reunited with the supreme soul. The true object of everyone's love, the reservoir of all beauty and grace, God. I was born in America, where I lived, there was no traffic jams. There was no pollution. Very peaceful place. People had all the material requirements and comforts they could possibly want. But yet the society was turbulent. It was the 1960s. Economically, the United States of America was on a peak of wealth. The middle class and upper class was spreading everywhere. But as a teenager, we saw people of a different color, the African Americans, were literally prisoners of the ghetto because of the color of their skin. And they had no chance that society gave them to get out. At the same time, there was a war raging in Vietnam. And as soon as you became 18 years old, you were subjected to the draft. My friends, brothers of my friends who were totally against this war were forced either go and fight for a war that you hate or spend the rest of your life in prison and never get a job for the rest of your days. Those were the only alternatives. There was a lot of unrest. This created a counterculture. Many of you are college students. In America in the 60s, the colleges were blazing with revolution. Why? They had all the comforts, all the promises, all the opportunities for luxurious life, but they understood things were wrong. Through music, through intoxications, through various philosophies and ideologies, people were trying to look deeper for something real. I was among them. I was stoned with bottles thrown into my face by white people because I was marching for the rights of the blacks. I was chased and tear gassed by club swinging police just making a peaceful demonstration against a war that was absolutely useless. But I began to realize that what I was really looking for was not political adjustments or social economic reforms. Nobody is really looking for that. We are all looking for that home. within our hearts, where there is a meaningful, purposeful, fulfilling life based on truth, where there is a platform where we can actually understand and realize the true equality of all living beings, where the love that we are longing to give and receive, unconditional love, is forever inherent. I began a spiritual search. I realized if I had no ideal I was willing to die for, I had nothing really meaningful to live for. And the greatest of all ideals is to be an instrument of God's love and compassion within this world. Beyond all sectarian, ritualistic, egoistic considerations. In Sanskrit, there was a word, satagrahi. A person who's really on a spiritual path is seeking the essence. I was young and confused, but something in my heart impelled me to seek that essence. Actually, if nothing else comes out of this book that was written, beyond this beautiful drama that the children performed, then, as far as I'm concerned, it was a success and worth the effort. My friend Gary he invited me to take a summer trip to Europe. And I was thinking, this is an opportunity to break away from the shackles of my preconditioned conceptions of who I am and what is right, and explore how other people and other cultures view real values and how they understand God. The first day we arrived in Europe, we were robbed of all the money we had. And our financier, Frank, immediately left back for America. But Gary and I were too excited to go back. And I found that this was a blessing. Going to places as a tourist, you learn what people want you to learn for their own financial purposes. But with nothing, you're forced to live among the common people and just be one of them. It was a beautiful experience. In the 1960s, music was a very, very important part of the path of enlightenment. And I was going to these big concerts and rock festivals, trying to find some enlightenment there. In the Isle of Wight, in England, was the biggest rock festival in the history of the world up until then. Jimi Hendrix gave his last major performance, and a few days later, not far from where I was staying, he died of an overdose of sleeping pills and alcohol. He was a multimillionaire. He was one of the most famous people on earth. He had incredible talent. But yet, such a frustrated and empty life that he died such a sad and useless death. Things like this separated me from the counterculture and helped me to focus my total energy on the journey internal, to search for my own soul and the real purpose of life. On that island of Crete, I cried, I prayed, I meditated, I read books for weeks, longing for direction. And I heard that voice, go to India. Why India? It's so far. I had never met an Indian in my entire life. The first Indian I ever met in my life was that lady security guard that you saw in the drama. But she helped me a lot on my spiritual path, actually. I went back to the cave, and I said to Gary, something amazing happened to me right at the sunset. And Gary said, something amazing happened to me. I said, what happened? He said, I heard a voice. I asked Gary, what did the voice say? And Gary replied, this voice told me, go to Israel. I said, what? Where did he say? I don't think I heard you properly. He said, Israel. He said, go to Israel. Don't you believe me? I said, I believe you. He said, well, let's go. I said, I heard a voice too. He said, then let's go. But he told me to go to India. Then there was silence for about a half hour as we were looking out into the stars. And I broke the silence. I'm leaving tomorrow. And began a hitchhiking excursion up the coast of Greece through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan. Many stories are there in this book. Many were edited out, actually. Not by Ram Dass, but by another editor. Ram Dass is so gracious, he kept everything. But I'd like to share one simple little story that's there. How many of you have heard of Kandahar? It's a city in Afghanistan. While I was living there, many traumatic experiences came upon me. One was very simple, but it had a deep impact. I was sitting in a tea stall with about six old men. They had baggy pants and very long, long kurta-type shirts and big, big turbans, just wrapped, covered with dust. There were holes. And Afghanistan at that time was the poorest country I'd ever seen in my life. And we were sitting there sipping on tea. There was no tables or chairs. Everyone was just crouched down on the ground. And a young boy maybe about 15 years old. He came in. He was blind, but there was nothing covering his eyes. It was grotesque. Both of his eyes were swollen, gray, terribly disfigured. The boy was emaciated, thin. He had rags for his clothes. And he carried an instrument, which was a wooden stick, and on one end of it was a tin can nailed to the stick, and then there was a wire, a piece of wire, that was nailed down on one end to the other end. It was a musical instrument. And he began to thump on this musical instrument. It was just like, boom, 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 boom. It wasn't a very harmonic instrument. But he thumped and began to sing songs in praise of God. And as he sang, his voice soared with enthusiasm. His entire expression became ecstatic. His body was emanating such light, such feeling. He sang for about a half hour, and all of us sat there listening, totally enthralled. And this, to me, was a total culture shock. Because I was taught and I was programmed my whole life. You work hard. You get a good education. You get a good job. You make a lot of money. You raise a good family. And you will be happy. But I can tell you honestly, I had never in my entire life seen anyone so happy as this blind, poverty-stricken boy as he was chanting the names of God. It confirmed something that was very deeply awakening in my heart. That real happiness is in love. And the truest and purest of all forms of love is the love of the soul for God. And because every living being is a part of God, where there is love for God, there is natural, spontaneous love for every living being. A couple days later, it's a long story, but I was sitting on a rooftop with a very, very wealthy trader who had international contacts. He invited me as his guest. And we were discussing philosophy. Suddenly, he said, "Mr. Richard, please excuse me for a moment, but I have some urgent duty to attend to." I couldn't believe what he did next. He cocked his head toward the moon and started howling like a wolf. "Awoo! Awoo!" I was thinking, this man has gone mad. Again and again, "Awoo!" Then he grabbed a rope and threw it off the roof. And about a minute later, he pulled the rope up, and there was a living mongoose that went into a little loop. He let the mongoose onto the roof, and then he sat and we started talking philosophy again. Another culture shock. I felt the sharp claws of this mongoose scaling my back. And like little Sloka, I had very long hair in those days. The mongoose really liked my hair. Not for fashion reasons. He crawled right up to my neck, curled up, and went to sleep. Have you ever had a mongoose sleeping in your neck? He was really heavy. I turned to my friend and I said, "What do I do now?" And he was sipping on his tea. He said, "Oh, he has found a good sleeping place." I said, "Well, it really hurts. Can you take him off?" He became very serious. He said, "Oh, there is a saying, never wake a sleeping mongoose." The mongoose is sacred to the Egyptians, and it is known for killing even the cobra, the deadliest of all snakes and the symbol of death. Said, "Mr. Richard, don't even move. If you do, he may rip your head to shreds." So I sat there. And he was talking philosophy, but I wasn't very attentive. And a couple hours went by and he said, "I have to go to sleep." So he left me all alone in the moonlight on the rooftop. And I was trying to adjust to this situation. And then insects started biting me. And my mind was kind of like that pantomime show. My mind was going mad. But then I began to think that every situation, this is what I have read in books from India, that every situation is an opportunity to grow if you just choose to do so. Maybe this mongoose is teaching me patience. Maybe this mongoose is teaching me how to turn to God and go deeper and deeper within, rather than just complaining and agonizing over a circumstance. It was one of the most enlightening nights I had ever spent up until then. When the sun rose, the mongoose crawled down my back and looked at me and almost bowed down as if he was thanking me for hospitality. And then my host woke up, put the mongoose in the rope and threw him down. And then he praised me. He said, "You gave really good hospitality to my mongoose." Actually, he didn't say my mongoose. He said one of my mongooses. And I was thinking that he said mongoose in the plural. I did not want to be around the next time he raised his head to the sky and began to cry, "Awoo!" So I thanked him for his hospitality and we continued the journey. Then I came to the border of India eventually. after 3,000 miles and 3 months of really risking my life, with this dream that of all places in the world, there is no better place to understand the greatest treasure of human existence than India. I had read the books, I had read histories, and I was absolutely convinced. And I had a calling. But for want of money, I was rejected. I prayed, I cried, and I learned that if you want something valuable, it does not come cheap. And finally, that Sikh security guard, when I promised him that someday I will really try to do something for your people, honestly, tears came to his eyes. He stamped my passport and welcomed me to India. A major reason in my own heart for writing this book was to show my gratitude to India and the people of India. From all of you, I have received the greatest wealth in all of creation. I know that many of you are hoping to get top grades and a job abroad where you can make big salaries. That's all right. That could be a beautiful thing. But please, don't chase after a mirage when the real oasis of nectarine water is right at your door. The culture, the history, the spirituality of this great land has been the inspiration for sincere seekers throughout the ages. I was very disappointed and discouraged by many of the Western religions because I found so much division and sectarianism connected to it. But in my study of Indian literature, I found a spiritual path that was so philosophically deep, so scientifically sound, and so inclusive that it accepted the essence of all great spiritual paths. In Delhi, I attended an international yoga conference where I met many known and unknown sages. Some of the more known were Swami Rama, Swami Satchidananda, Jay Krishnamurti, Mr. Iyengar. At the end of the conference, the different yogis came on stage and started fighting with each other over whose turn it was to speak. That was another test. The persons who I named, they were very much standing with great integrity. But others, was very confusing. From there I went to the Himalayas. On the bank of the Ganges in Rishikesh, on the eastern bank, I sat and meditated and prayed, seeing the Himalayas and the waters of Ganga Devi just thrilled me. After many hours, one sadhu approached me from the forest. He was carrying something in his hand, looking down in the ground. I stood up to receive him. And he said, "I know you because I've been watching you for a long time, but you do not know me. I have come to give you the robes of a sadhu. Now take off your Western dress and offer it to the river Ganges." I put on a lungi and a chador and took my jeans and turtleneck shirt and offered into the swift flowing current of Ganga Devi. And then he told me something. He said, "The Ganga will become your mother. You will understand this in time." I sat on a rock in the Ganges, praying to God and to Ganga Devi to help me on this spiritual path, and found if we really deeply want wisdom, it is revealed wherever we may be. I saw around me the beautiful current of the Ganges. It was the month of December. Crystal clear, aqua blue, swirling. And I was thinking that every moment Mother Ganga is creating a masterpiece of art. But in the same moment, it's gone. No artist in human history could ever fully capture the beauty of one moment of the Ganga's current. And I was thinking, isn't this the way life is? Material nature, everything is always changing. Nothing is stable. As soon as something appears, it is vanishing by the power of time. But the beauty of the current of Ganga, down deep, is forever. If we go deep into our perceptions of this world with a spiritual perspective, we find an everlasting truth which is not subjected to the fickle waves of the joys and sorrows of this world. The Ganges begins in Gangotri, in the peaks of Himalayas, and is coming down. And never stops its current until it reaches the sea. On the way, so many impediments. Giant trees fall into the current, massive rocks, and even mountains. Yet Mother Ganga flows around, under, over, somehow or other, never stops its path to the sea. Similarly, whatever impediments there may be in our life, they are like rocks in the river of life. And if we learn from the Ganga to always persevere, to somehow or other manage to get around every impediment, with the help of God, we will all reach the sea of our innermost aspiration. But as the Ganges is flowing, I was watching. There were trees, there were leaves, there were flowers, there was dead buffaloes, there was even some dead human corpses. If they just stay within the current, they will reach the sea, the ultimate destination of Ganga. But most things will be diverted to the banks. And as soon as you're diverted to the banks, you don't go anywhere further. Similarly, in a spiritual path, there will be many temptations, many diversions, many alternatives, inviting us to come out from the current of the teachings of God, of the scriptures and the Guru. Only those who remain in the current of that grace will reach the sea of human life's true destination. And I prayed, as Mother Kunti prayed, Twai me nanya vishaya mathir madhupate sakrit ratim udvasthatad adudha Gange Bogam Udanvati. The Bhagavad Kunti says, as the river Ganges forever flows to the sea without hindrance, let my attraction be to you, my sweet Lord, without being diverted to anything or anyone else. After about a month of sitting on the Ganga's bank in a rock from sunrise to sunset, I went to stay for some time at the ashram of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and then to a cave of a great yogi named Mahavirdas Tatwala Baba. Then I decided to go higher into the Himalayas. I crossed the Lakshman Jeweler and went into the forest, and suddenly I was terrified. There were people with deformed bodies, their noses melting into their faces, their fingers bloody stubs, absolute poverty. Some were sleeping in little holes in the ground, covering themselves with dirt as blankets. Suddenly, about 20 of them surrounded me and stuck their bloody stubs in my face with desperate eyes, screaming out, Bakshish! Bakshish! I had stumbled into a leprosy colony. They made such a tight circle around me, I could not move. The smell of their rotting flesh and breath was very difficult to tolerate. Would I get leprosy like them? These thoughts came into my mind. But I honestly had no money, but they would not let me go. This was a culture shock for someone who was brought up in the suburbs of Chicago. Finally, they patted me down and searched me completely until they were convinced I had nothing, and they let me go. I was trembling. I took a few steps and then stopped in my tracks. What I saw was something that changed my life. Do I have time to tell you?
No!
I was hoping you would say that. Thank you. There was an old leper woman laying at her side. Her nose melted into a hole in her face. Her skin just totally deformed. No fingers, no toes. But her eyes were filled with light. She gazed into my eyes with the love of a mother. I saw in her a yearning, a longing for someone to accept her motherly love. Perhaps years went by and nobody accepted that love that she wanted to give to someone. She had such sympathy for what I had just been through. She folded her palms and then with one of her fingerless hands, she offered me a blessing with tears in her eyes. I ran up to her, knelt down, and put my head under her hand. And she cried out in Hindi, "Son, may God bless you. May God bless you, my son." And I looked up into her face. It was illuminated with this supernatural joy. Tears of ecstasy fell from her eyes. She was the most beautiful woman I have ever seen. Not the beauty of the skin, but the beauty of her heart. She thanked me, and I thanked her. I was willing to accept the love that she so longed to give someone. I went to the bank of the Ganges again, which was my favorite place for trying to understand what was going on in my life. And I looked at the current, and I was thinking, the Ganga here is very deep. And all I could see is what's on the surface. There's some waves. Every now and then a fish jumps up. But underneath this surface, there's a whole civilization of various kinds of fish and rocks and vegetation. Isn't this like life? Our tendency is to see things only on its surface. But if we actually look deep down inside, we will see something that's so much more meaningful. Sometimes we judge or even hate people because of how they look or how they behave. But deep down inside, they may be reacting to abuse. They may have been abused in the past. They may have been traumatized. They may have been neglected. If we really try to understand the person more deeply, instead of feeling hateful and judgmental, we will probably feel sympathetic and compassionate. Because every living being is essentially good. But we are conditioned in so many ways. Like that leper woman, on the surface, she was ugly and diseased. But like the river Ganga, when I looked below the surface, I saw who she really was. A beautiful, loving, motherly person. This was a very, very valuable lesson in my spiritual journey that helped me to rise above sectarian, judgmental prejudices. Higher in the Himalayas, at Dev Prayag, I met Kailash Baba, an old devotee of Shiva, who taught me how to live as an ascetic in the forest. Then I went to the ashram of Anandamayi Ma, a saintly lady who loved me and treated me like her own son. So gracious and kind. And after that, I lived with the Nagababas. They were very different than Anandamayi Ma. They were also very gracious and kind to me, but in their own way. They were determined to teach me lessons that I would never forget. And if you'd like to know more, you can read the book. I met mystics who were performing supernatural feats beyond what logic or science can explain. And I met so many of those people that it became like a normal thing. It was supernatural, what we would call miracles. When you live with those kinds of people, it's just like crossing the street. Once you get used to it, there's nothing very impressive about it. But what was impressive was people who had deep love and good character. I descended to Varanasi, where I lived at the Burning Ghats to study the nature of death, watching one body after another burn, and seeing the reactions to the relatives and the loved ones. Many good realizations, because death is inevitable to all of us. Whether we are black or brown or white or red or yellow, whether we are men or women, rich or poor, Indian, Pakistani, Israeli, Palestinian, American, Russian, or anything else, eventually we just, all that's left of this, of all these material designations, is a pile of ashes that's swept into the Ganges or thrown into the earth. Then I went to Bodh Gaya and studied under Buddhist masters, a Zen Buddhist master. Satyanarayan Goenkaji just began his Vipassana courses. I was one of his first students, Burmese meditation. And then I went to Calcutta. I went to Kalighat. And then had a very different experience when I met with Mother Teresa. And she said something that I found to be so universal in the principle of bhakti. She told me the real problem in this world is hunger. Not hunger of the belly, hunger of the heart. The only thing that can satisfy the heart's hunger is God's love. She said, I have seen in London, in New York, in Los Angeles, in Sydney, I've been everywhere. She said, I see, even among the richest, most powerful people in the world, they are starving in their hearts because their lives are so superficial. But many of these poor people in the ghettos of Calcutta, as they die in my arms, I see a spark of hope and truth in their eyes. Something I hardly see anywhere in the Western world. The greatest service to humanity is to feed the heart by giving God's love. But we have to be pure to give that love. From there I came to Bombay. That's what it was called in those days, Bombay. And I took another course in Buddhist meditation, and I have to end soon. But one day I just went walking down the street for no reason except to walk. I walked for miles, and then I saw a big sign advertising a spiritual festival. I went there, and by evening, about 20,000 people gathered in a huge pandal at Cross Maidan. And I saw foreign people playing mridangas and kartals and singing. And then His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, came on stage. And I was in the very back of everyone. And I could hardly see, because we have these big screens, I think. And there's only a few thousand people here. Imagine 10 or 20 times as many people as tonight with no screens. I was thinking, I wish I could see him. But I felt shy to get in front of anyone else. Then I saw Prabhupada talk something in another devotee's ear, and that devotee started looking, and then signaling for someone to come, but nobody came. So he came down into the crowds, crossed through the entire ocean of people, walked right up to me, took my hand, and said, Prabhupada wants you to sit next to him. I asked him, how does Prabhupada know me? How does Prabhupada know me? He didn't answer. He just said, come, and pulled me onto the stage. And there Srila Prabhupada welcomed me. And I sat about where these flowers were on the ground. And for the next 2 weeks, Prabhupada had me sit beside him as he gave his lectures and performed his kirtans. And there was something deeply moved me. But I was not convinced who my guru was. So after the festival was over, I left. I went to Ganesh Puri, where I was at Nityananda Baba's samadhi and then lived with Swami Muktananda. And then from there I went back to the Himalayas, where I lived in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery that was under the Dalai Lama of Tibet. And I met and studied under him and his people. And I traveled to Ayodhya to study Ram, and to Prayag, and eventually I was in Kathmandu Valley at this place called Swayambhunath. And one day I decided I'm just going to take a walk, because I was sitting in meditation all day, every day for many days. So I just walked. I walked to Kathmandu and then started coming back through miles of rice paddies. It was about this time of the year. Blue clouds formed in the sky. began to drizzle. I understood a monsoon downpour was about to happen. You all know here in India what a rice paddy is. There's just a very thin border, and all the rest is very deep mud where the rice is growing. So I saw what appeared to be a little old man walking with an umbrella a distance away, and I ran as fast as I could on this little ridge. And just when I came to him, it started pouring rain, and I walked behind his umbrella. And both of us were afraid of falling into the rice paddy, so neither of us, he never turned around. Maybe 10 or 15 minutes we walked together until the rain stopped. And then I was going to go another direction. I said, "Thank you." He turned around. His eyes were shocked. He dropped his umbrella in the mud. It was Gary. We embraced. And I told him that you should become a sadhu. He had went to Israel, spent about a year, and then came to India, and he was living with all Western people. So I snatched him away and taught him the life of a sadhu, and we jumped in a third-class train, and we were on our way to Amarnath to go to a pilgrimage for Lord Shiva. And on the way, we stopped in Varanasi, and I prayed to Kashi Vishwanath, "Please show me my path. Please show me my path." The train was stuck in the middle of a field for about 24 hours because it was flooding with rain. And there was no place to sit in the third class compartment. But somehow or other, we just stood there. There was nothing else to do. No eating, no sleeping, no drinking for about a day and a half. Finally, the train started moving. Movement really makes you feel nice. And then it stopped at a station, so we crawled over people out a window just to get some air, drink some water. And the train started moving, and the train was so crowded we could not get in. We were stranded in an unknown place. When the train was gone and the crowds cleared, Gary said to me, "Now what?" I said, "I don't know. Let us see what God has in mind." So I asked some sadhus sitting in the track platform, "Where am I?" He said, "This is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace." And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday. So we celebrated Janmashtami. We didn't know what it was, but we celebrated. And I was bathing in the Jamuna the next morning, and I heard something about Vrindavan, and I said to Gary, "I'm going to Vrindavan. I'll meet you there tomorrow." So I went, and then he came. And it was really crowded because of the Janmashtami crowds. And Gary wanted to go to the Himalayas toward Amarnath. I said, "In 4 days, I'll meet you at Haridwar, under the clock at Brahmagat." And I stayed in Vrindavan for 2 days. And on the third day, I prayed that something magical about this place is affecting my heart, but I have to go meet Gary. The next morning, I could not move. I had typhoid fever. Laying on the bank of the Yamuna, vulture circling above me, for hours and hours and hours. until the farmer threw me in the back of his ox cart and took me to a charitable hospital. And the doctor said, "You cannot travel for at least a month or you will die." So during that month in Vrindavan, understanding what is bhakti, what is the concept of Bhagavan or Krishna, I learned that there are three aspects of God that are eternally existing. Brahman, the all-pervading, impersonal existence of the Lord, who certain yogis, they aspire to merge into the oneness of that Brahman. And then there is the Lord as Paramatma, who is seated as the guide within everyone's heart. And Bhagavan, the all-beautiful Supreme Person, whose body is Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. And only through bhakti, only through love, does Bhagavan reveal himself within our hearts and within everything and everyone. This concept of bhakti completely transformed me. I realized in all inclusiveness, everything was there. And the charm of Vrindavan and Radha, the feminine, compassionate aspect of the Absolute Truth, convinced me as the months went by that this is my path. How that transformation took place, the magical, mystical, beautiful experiences of Vrindavan, I don't have time to tell you, but if you like, you can read the book. It was there that I accepted the path of bhakti. It was there that I accepted my Gurudev, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. And it was there that I decided to assist him in being an instrument of that love according to my capacity in my life. I was stationed in America for many years, but in my heart of hearts, I yearned to fulfill my promise and do something, at least try to do something, to show my gratitude and love for the people of India. In 1986, we started our temple in Chopati. And to conclude, I simply want to express, I'm full of faults, but by my Gurudev's mercy, he's giving me a chance to serve. And I am forever grateful to all of you, to your great tradition, to your great culture, to your great nation. For giving me the greatest treasure, the greatest pleasure, and the most meaningful purpose of life. Thank you very much. I sincerely beg everyone to please stay for the performance of Gurvani and as kindred spirits. They travel all around America and all around the world. Gurvani is an American who from, I was explaining this Sunday, I know his parents. They're two of my dearest friends, godbrother and godsister, Rukmini Devi and Bhardraj Prabhu. They were two of the earliest disciples of my Gurudev. They prayed and they cried to have a child who would spread love of God, bhakti, throughout the world. And their prayer was fulfilled in Gurvani Prabhu. They have taken the essence of Western music, of all different varieties, of Eastern music, and synthesized them as an offering of pure love and devotion. And wherever they go, Americans, Africans, Europeans, Australians, South Africans, Indians, people cry, people rejoice, because of the experience of their true love for the chanting of God's holy names. So please, it will be a lifetime cultural experience, and I'm forever indebted to you, Gurvani, and I'm forever indebted to all of you. Hare Krishna.
Thank you so much, Guru Maharaj. I want to announce that the journey home is available this evening after the concert as you leave, and they've made a special concession.